But the sense that I got was, yes, they just really love the garden and the community that it provides, and they're scared that any major change to that would disrupt how that feels for them. The person that I was speaking with, like, they joined the garden during COVID at a time when they felt disconnected from community, and this was something that let them feel like they were connected again. And I could really like hear that emotion in their voice. I think there are some people who really love the space, and I think maybe that is resulting in them accepting some of these fear-based arguments a lot more than they should, and a lot more than the facts actually support.
This is a real thing. Real thing.
None of you have the balls to stop this. Stop this.
I've got plenty of time. I have nothing else going on today.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now. 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 Right now.
We're back on the Wedge Live podcast. I'm your host, John Edwards, and today we're going to answer with our guest, Jordan Like, can a garden coexist with an ADA accessible trail in the Whittier neighborhood? Welcome, Jordan.
Thank you. Very happy to be here. Longtime listener.
I read your post on Streets MN. If people want to learn about this, you have included so much great detail in your streets.mn post, so they should read that and also listen to this. You seem to have come out on the side that yes, a community garden can coexist with an ADA accessible trail, so that people know where we're coming from. Why did you take an interest in this topic? Why did you write a whole long, pretty well-researched and detailed post on this topic in particular?
Yeah, it is, I think it is pretty thorough. I'll be honest, I didn't know about the controversy or the topic before I started looking into it for this article. Amy Gage, the editor of Streets MN, had been trying to get me to write something. I had some ideas, but then she asked if I would be willing to look into this issue. And I thought it would be an easy one for my first article. Just ADA accessible ramp to the Midtown Greenway. But that wasn't quite the case.
It's the Sioux Line Garden. I don't know if we've said that. It's in Whittier between Garfield and Harriet Avenues. How big would you say this garden is? I looked on Google Maps. Am I right to say it's like about six standard size Minneapolis lots? That seem right?
I mean, maybe it's about an acre.
About an acre. Pretty big.
Yeah, it's a pretty good sized garden. There are, I believe, 97 garden plots on it, as well as some unpaved paths.
Now we can get into why are they opposing this trail? Because can I run through the list of complaints here from the garden?
Oh yeah, I think you should.
So the top four that stand out, some of them kind of bleed together, but the top four that stand out is toxic soil. Like the construction of the path is somehow going to turn up soil that is deep underground. And it will endanger people who are growing food there or hanging out there. Another one is, this is weird, fast bike traffic will endanger the children. okay. Because bikes would also be able to use this trail that is ADA accessible. Fewer pollinators, so like bees and stuff, they will go away or be killed somehow. And it will eliminate 25 to 40. These are all claims from the Stop the Destruction website put up by the people who garden there. It will eliminate 25 to 40% of garden plots. And the county says it will eliminate 5% of space, which seems more realistic. Like when I think of a space this size, putting a trail on it to access the Greenway, I can't imagine how that would take 40% of the space. It's just like common sense tells you that claim, 25 to 40% of the space. How could that even be possible? It feels like these claims are very exaggerated, and it makes me skeptical just on the surface that anything they're saying is true. I'm sorry to start out very negative on the gardener's argument, but that is my impression by just acquainting myself with some of the facts here.
You know, and that is the first, one of the first things that I read in researching this was their Stop the Destruction page on the Sulheim Community Garden website. And if anyone is interested, I do recommend going and looking at what they wrote about this, because it's fairly apocalyptic.
Yeah.
In their wording. Yeah, all of these things I think have been addressed by Hennepin County, and we can kind of go through them one at a time, I think, if you want.
Yeah. Toxic soil. Tell me about the toxic soil.
Well, so it is on, I don't know what you would call it, a former brown site. So there did used to be potentially some level of environmental pollution on the site, and they've done some remediation there as part of gardening. But the construction of the trail doesn't involve really any excavation, or at least not below the level that is done just for normal gardening.
So right.
That doesn't really seem like a concern.
It's along the Greenway, and so a lot of this land is formerly industrial because it's a rail. It's a, you know, where trains used to go through, freight trains.
Yeah. And I mean, there's, you know, serious issues in the area. You know, you've got like the Smith Foundry environmental issue. But this one, it's been reviewed, or the project is being reviewed by the appropriate environmental agencies, I suppose.
So they are concerned about like fast bike and scooter traffic, I believe. And they do mention children will be put in danger on the website. Unsafe for children is the quote. It's an access point to the Greenway. I imagine you could design it in a way that's not super fast. I know getting on the Greenway at like where the Midtown Exchange building is, they have that access point that's kind of curvy. I never really get up super fast in that area. It feels like any park, just be careful when you're riding your bikes around pedestrians. Feels like we could handle that. It would be okay.
That example that you gave is a good one. I never end up going very quickly, going very fast on that ramp near the Midtown Global Market. And this one, you know, the county has made some concessions changes to the plan, partially in response to this concern about bikes and scooters moving too fast. A normal bike path tends to be at least 10 feet. Mm-hmm. And this one, now they've reduced it from 10 feet to 8 feet. And it does meander quite a bit. If you look at the design, there are, you know, if you're trying to get from street level down to the Greenway or vice versa, there's 4 or 5 almost 90-degree turns just getting between the two. And I don't know how you would really get up to speed without crashing. So as far as the children go, I think they have some neighborhood kids who play in the gardens. You know, I think that the current ramps and access to the Greenway for kids, it's kind of steep and difficult, and that seems pretty unsafe for kids as well. And I think that this ramp would be easier for them to get on, whether they use a trike or a balance bike or whatever they're using.
We let kids loose in our parks. They would probably be safe around a bike trail in a garden, just like they're safe around a bike trail in the parks. I think the pollinator issue. Pollinators will have their habitat destroyed and go away.
That one, I'm not really sure. I followed the exact argument. The path is going to, for most of its proposed route, follow an existing unpaved path. I think they're concerned that it would tear up some pollinator plants that exist, and maybe happen during the winter or something when bees are asleep under the ground or something. So like remove their habitat, but also kill them in the process. Hennepin County has said that they will plan their activities around those two things to mitigate that.
Okay. Well, that doesn't seem like, it seems like a thing you could plan around if you're aware of it and trying from the beginning. Do we need to address the 25 to 40% of garden plots eliminated?
I think that they're using a different, Hennepin County is using one metric and then the garden is using a different one. Hennepin County is using like the total amount of garden worthy land that will be lost as part of this project, which is in their estimate, 5%. And then the garden, they think that they're using the percentage of plots that will be impacted or lost.
Oh, so if it, so like, even if touches... like
a part of it is being lost and not all of it, but the Hennepin County is saying, well, yeah, you might, this plot might be lost right there, but you can move it to a different part of the garden.
So it's like if I-95 goes up the east coast of the United States, if you included all the land area of every state that I-95 touched, it would add up to some very large proportion of the United States. Is it, do I have a good analogy here?
I mean, sort of. It's, it will impact, it, like it'll impact it, some existing lots and plot garden plots. And here's why that's maybe a bigger deal for this garden than some others. This garden is a little bit unusual in that they allow perennial plants to be planted. And that's not true in other park board gardens.
Yeah.
And so you have returning, and they also allow people who have gardened there before to, like, if they're a member in good standing and they did their volunteer time and paid their money, they get to come back and garden that same plot the next year. So some of these that are going to go away are ones that people have had for many years. I think each year, like, 80% of the gardeners stick around.
Yeah. So that's probably a good place to transition to. You write about the park board's equity standards for community gardens, because there are community gardens through the city, many of them on parkland. Some of them are new. The park board has taken this on as a priority to provide places for people to grow food and engage in community gardens. And they have standards. One of them is ADA compliance. And another one is equity and making sure it's not just the incumbents every year who get to hold on to their garden plot. Everyone has to reapply every year, and nobody's got special treatment because they've been there for year after year. And this garden does not have to comply with those requirements for the ADA accessibility and the equity. Were they grandfathered in? Can you talk about the history and why they don't have to comply with these standards?
Yes, they were grandfathered in. The garden's been around since 1991. At the time, it was a tax forfeited parcel. It was, you know, just there was nothing going on that land. And so some neighbors banded together, formed a community garden. Eventually, I think maybe to avoid redevelopment of the land, they got the park board to acquire it from the county. And so at that, in maybe 2011, I think it became property of the park board. But as a part of that, they didn't require them to become like any of the other community gardens within the park system. And so they have their own, completely own rules and regulations. I think there's maybe one section where that they have to comply by, but equity and accessibility and all of those things, they're only encouraged to follow the park board's rules.
Here's another thing that I noticed on the website that doesn't match what is actually true about the county's plans. So the Stop the Destruction website from the Soo Line Garden says the county wants a 12-foot path. What I read in your post, the county's plan is they compromised down from a 10-foot path to an 8-foot path. So it's 66% of the path size that the gardeners are claiming. I don't know. I feel like if you're going to make these claims, do some fact-checking, make sure they're true, because you're already making some apocalyptic claims. When I find these factual discrepancies, I get very suspicious.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you dig into some of the other claims too, they didn't really stand up to scrutiny. But that's the very first claim that they make, right, is that there's a 12-foot paved path that's going to go through the garden. And then it's just very, very easy to look into it and see that it's now 8 feet. And they're, you know, I mentioned that to them in an email to the board of the garden, and they haven't done anything to update that post. What they would say there in response to that specific complaint is that it's an 8-foot path, but then there's 2 feet on either side that won't be gardenable. They'll be putting down clover or some other friendly grass. Because you can't have a path right up against the fencing for a garden plot. Still misleading, though.
It is, because you might think, well, if it's 12-foot path, then it's going to be like 15, 16 feet of ungardenable space.
It sounds unreasonably wide when you put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So often when you dig into people who are opposed to a thing, and this is a weird one, because when I think of community garden rising up to oppose change, like you said in your post on streets.mn, it's often like a housing development issue. Like, we've been gardening on this land, they want to build housing here. No, we want to keep gardening here. We don't want to lose all of our space, but this is a bike trail. But often what you find in these cases, the claims that are made against like a bike lane or a new housing project or other things, it's not really about what people say it's about. Like the thing in St. Paul where it's about the trees. Well, I get the impression a lot of people are concerned about other things on Summit Avenue or these other bike trails. It's not really about the trees. They're just saying the thing that is politically expedient and most convincing, they think. Like, they're making political arguments.
Yeah.
Can you speak to how sincere the gardeners are about all of these claims? Are they just throwing the kitchen sink at the problem? Or do they believe some of these things?
Yeah, you know, I should qualify by saying that I don't think all of the gardeners oppose this plan. I've had some existing and past gardeners reach out and express support for it after they read the article. And, you know, they didn't even need to read the article to know that they supported it. But the leadership and some other vocal gardeners are definitely against it. I think, you know, a couple of them actually found out that I was writing the article and asked if they could call me and humanize the issue. And, you know, we spent 20 or 30 slightly awkward minutes talking through it. But the sense that I got from them was, yes, they just really love the garden and the community that it provides. And they're scared that any major change to that would disrupt how that feels for them. The person that I was speaking with, like, they joined the garden during COVID at a time when they felt disconnected from community, and this was something that let them feel like they were connected again. And, you know, I could really like hear that emotion in their voice. I think there's some people who really love the space, and I think maybe that is resulting in them accepting some of these fear-based arguments a lot more than they should, and a lot more than the facts actually support. So I don't want to think that there are bad intentions here, but the facts just don't back up what they're saying.
I don't know if we've mentioned that there's currently a path to access the Greenway through the garden, which is a mulch trail. It's a soft surface trail. I walk through it a bunch. And when I do, I see like they have signs posted, and I think maybe they use the word destruction in the signs they have posted. And if I didn't like look into it further, I would think, well, the big bad county or the park board wants to destroy this thing. And I wonder how much the messaging has a lot of people who are not like in leadership positions of the garden who are not really all that familiar. Like, yeah, save the garden. You're damn right, save the garden. Why would you take my garden away from me? So I get frustrated because it's not going to be covered on the TV news. It's difficult to dig up all this information about what is really planned for the space. So of course you're going to take for granted that your friends from the garden are telling you the truth.
I think that's true. They also have said that, or made the claim that there is an alternate location that the county could very easily use just across the Greenway from the garden. And so I think that's easy for the gardeners to latch onto as well. That why would you cause harm to our garden or take away some of our space when you could just move it somewhere else?
Right, to the south side of the Greenway instead of the north side. What I found interesting about that, I think it's the county who wants to preserve the possibility of transit down where the where the rail tracks used to be on the greenway. And so like, no, we can't do that on that side of the greenway. It will get in the way of our future plans for transit. And then you've got a couple of bike organizations who have signed on in opposition to the idea of a trail through the garden. I don't know if they've weighed in specifically on the alternative idea for the south side, but did you speak with the Greenway Coalition about that?
I did, yeah. So the executive director of the Midtown Greenway Coalition is Soren Jensen, and he is very convinced that transit is never coming to the Greenway.
Can I stop you a moment? So are his comments and signing on with the gardeners in opposition to the access on that side about throwing up a roadblock for transit? Like how I don't want to attribute bad faith, but I just like I got the impression like, is he trying to let's put it on the side that will inhibit future transit because I'm the guy and this is the organization that opposes future transit. Let's load up that side of the Greenway with access points to make it hard to do transit.
You know, I'm not sure if that's where he's coming from. I do know that if you truly believed that transit was never going to come there, then yeah, you'd be more likely to think, well, why not build it on this other side where nothing currently exists? I just think it exhibits charitably. Let's just say he doesn't have ulterior motives. Then it just doesn't show very much foresight. We don't know how that population and ridership on transit along that corridor is going to change in the next 10 years. I think we see from other light rail projects that it's pretty important to preserve the ability to build easily and not have severe cost overruns and timeline overruns.
Yeah.
So. It just seems pretty irresponsible to say, yeah, let's build some permanent infrastructure in the space that is intended for future transit use.
So I like Soren Jensen. Let's assume that he is operating entirely in good faith and means what he says. And I like the Midtown Greenway Coalition. So there's federal funding. This project has federal funding. This is another thing about like, no, not here. Do it in the other place that we haven't planned for. We don't have money for. And it's off in the future. Do it that way. And who knows how long it'll take to do it this other way or if it's even viable and who will oppose it mm-hmm. when you do propose it for that side of the green. Or who are the constituencies that pisses off? That happens a lot with bike infrastructure. It's like, no, not this street, some other street that you haven't included in any of your plans that will take a really long time to do and will piss off a whole bunch of other people. But there's federal funding allocated to this. It's been planned for a while. And so if you don't do this access point, no guarantee you get another one. And it certainly won't be soon. Can you talk about the trade-offs there?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, there's $1.1 million in federal funding for this project. That's the vast majority of the funding for this project. And the rest is coming from parkland dedication funds. They've already gotten a one-year extension. The county has gotten a one-year extension on this project. And so they need to submit this project for approval for that federal funding by April 1st of this year or risk losing it all. And, you know, this project has been in the works since 2018 or earlier. You know, we're running on 6 years now of planning and several years of community engagement and, you know, all sorts of changes to the project. So, yeah, the south side of the Greenway hasn't been studied. You're right. We know some of the issues that it would run into, including like needing to buy a small piece of land from an apartment complex there and move some electrical things, but we don't know about other things because it hasn't been studied. So I think it would be maybe difficult and very time consuming to get that funding again and to get people excited about putting this in. It really seems like if it doesn't get built, then we are just going to not have an ADA ramp in this area for another at least 5 or 6 years.
Or our lifetimes. I get frustrated as I get older As I get older, I get frustrated with how long things take because I'm feeling my own mortality. It's like we adopted a 2040 plan. We're 5 years into it. And it's basically a 10-year plan, and it's been held up by an endless lawsuit. I don't want to get off on this tangent, but like things take so long. Yeah. We should probably like let them happen. So
I agree. And, you know, I think it's worth pausing for a second to think about why this project is necessary in the first place.
Yeah.
Because this is, you know, we have this gem of a trail system right through the heart of our city in the Midtown Greenway. I think sometimes even I like forget just how cool that is and just how much use it gets. But the problem here and what they're trying to solve with this project is that there's a 1.27 mile gap in an accessible ramp. And by accessible ramp, I mean that it needs to be less than a 5% grade from there can't be any section of the ramp that is more than a 5% grade, because that's what people can manage on a wheelchair.
Well, that's interesting. So you'd have to basically go down to Uptown and the mall area to enter on Humboldt for an accessible entrance, or the new ramp at I-35W near Stevens Ave and 35. That's the gap they're trying to fill.
Exactly. There are three ramps that are too steep, have more than a 5% grade, and several staircases. And that's it right now. So, you know, somebody like me, I can manage that on my bike. I'm fairly confident in being able to ride up it with strength and confidence in my braking ability. But, you know, they're just, I think of so many people in my life who can't manage those. I have four nieces and nephews who are under the age of 5, and, you know, some of them go in strollers and some are on little bikes, and none of them could manage that. And so, you know, if they were in that situation, they'd have to be carried up or something. It'd just be really difficult for them. And, you know, you can extend that to all sorts of different people. Once you're on the Midtown Greenway, though, it's very flat, you know?
Right. You also talk about how this could be an opportunity for the garden to leverage the opportunity to create accessible plots in the garden. Like, they're not taking advantage of this to change their garden in a way that makes it more accessible for the gardeners.
Right. I'm hopeful that some of the people in leadership and otherwise will recognize and see this as more of an opportunity rather than just a risk. Because right now, you know, from multiple sides, if you're trying to come up from the Greenway, or if you're especially if you're trying to come from Harriet, there's no way for someone to be able to get in on a wheelchair, or even just if you have a little bit of trouble walking, like it's rough. And I heard about someone messaged me to say that they wanted that they use a wheelchair and are a landscape architect, and they would like to meet up with the garden board to, you know, do a little walkthrough of the area and just show them ways that they could, you know, improve the site for more accessible use.
Right.
Just show them how difficult it is for people to use right now, and how it would, you know, unlock this community asset for really everyone to use it instead of just able-bodied people.
Because it's just a slope. It's just like a slope on the edge of the Greenway. And if I was the garden and leadership of the garden, and I'm thinking, well, what ways would I change this site that we have kind of just kind of grown into over the years as it was? And I had this opportunity to change it in any way I wanted and work with the county, who has secured like $1 million in federal funding. I think I would want to listen and be like, yeah, what cool things can we do for the garden with all this money, since we're going to be adding this trail in? It seems like, I don't know how much they have talked. I see the county trying to accede to their demands, but I guess it has not worked.
Yeah, not so far. It seems like they're just pretty dead set against this at all. And the current users are going to, of the garden, are going to age. you know, and as they age, like, I think it will be harder for them to use the garden. I think it would be good for them to build a space that they can continue using into their upper years.
You make a point in your piece about how many people live in Whittier. I think it's like close to 15,000 people. I often say this is the densest part of Minneapolis, the Wedge Whittier area, when I'm arguing for increased transit amenities and, you know, more housing, things like that. It's a lot of people here. You make a point about how many people use the Greenway. And you also make a point, not to the gardener's benefit, about how few gardeners there are. So lots of people in the neighborhood, very few gardeners using this. And here's a way to add an amenity to the neighborhood. I don't know. I've made your point for you, but do you feel like you want to add anything to that?
I think it's worth, you know, spelling out, really. I mean, I think that there are a total of 150 to 200 gardeners, right? Cutting out, let's say, even a quarter of those, you'd be impacting maybe 50 gardeners per year, right? While expanding, providing an accessible path down would be used by, I want to say, at least hundreds, if not thousands, of neighbors who live close by. And so, you know, when we're talking about space like this, of course there are trade-offs involved, right? Yeah, it seems like the garden wants to position themselves as for the community, but then is fighting this thing that would be, you know, a boon for the community. And probably more so than what the garden, a few extra garden plots currently provide.
Let's talk about the politics. So the park board signed on with a letter of support in 2018. Did we already talk about how the park board has changed since then? Did we already go over this?
We did not.
So let's talk about how the park board has changed. They were previously for this, and then we can talk about like what people can do, because apparently this is coming up in the next month or so. For another approval from the park board. Park board has to sign off. Park board was for it. Now maybe they're not anymore because the politics has changed.
Yeah. In the 2021 election, there was a lot of turnover, right, on the park board. I know only of the view of one sitting member right now, and that's Commissioner Elizabeth Schaefer. The lot is within her district, and she is against it, right? She has the take of, I'm not against an ADA compliant path, just not here, right? Like we talked about. And so I don't know how many people she's going to, or are going to get on board with that. I think that there's a real risk of it being overturned. And, you know, I think that would be a real shame, and really not in sticking with the stated and expressed goals and mission of the park board.
Yeah. Commissioner Schaefer represents the Wedge and Whittier and points to the west and north, I think, if I have the map in my head correct. So if you're in the Wedge, Whittier area and other places listening to this, you probably are you very well may be represented by Commissioner Schaefer. And you should contact her and say, reconsider your position and consider all the good things this will do for so many of your constituents if it gets built. That's one action you can take. Jordan, are there other actions people should be taking? What should they be doing? Is there a meeting coming up people can talk to? Should they be watching agendas? Is this imminent?
Right. So because the county needs to submit their materials on this project by April 1st, it really needs to be presented to the park board in March. I asked the project director from the county when that was going to happen, and they didn't have a firm date from the park board yet, but I would say definitely watch for the next park board meeting. I would hope that it's going to be on the agenda so that you can get a fair hearing and a vote in good time. But also, you know, even if you don't live in, you know, the area represented by Commissioner Schaefer, you know, just contact all of your park board reps.
Yeah, the at-large people, too.
Absolutely. And I believe that after my article came out, R Streets wrote up a nice little post that included a sort of form letter that you can take and build off of if you want to email your park board reps. It included all of their emails in there as well.
Okay. Well, Jordan, you recently changed your Twitter handle. I know Twitter is dying a slow death, but you changed your Twitter handle from Jim Jorts to just your name now.
Just my name.
Depriving me of the joy of putting Jim Jorts under your name on the YouTube version of this podcast.
That's right. You know, when I first chose that name, I had zero followers, I think, on Twitter. And I just thought that, you know, picturing someone going to the gym in their jorts was pretty funny. Now when I think of jorts, I think of the mayor. And
yeah, it feels like a Jim Jorts
kind of sounds... I promise that it wasn't. But, you know, Jim Jorts also sounds a little too much like Jim Jordan. And I don't want that association.
Does sound like Minnesota's worst Republican politician, Jim Jorts.
Jim Jorts. So now I'm just Jordan like, and until I think of some other funny name.
Do you have any recommendations prepared? I don't know if you listen to the podcast, but I often ask people, what are you enjoying?
I do.
Do you have any new hobbies? Anything like a favorite place to take a walk? What do you enjoy lately that you can recommend to other people?
Yeah. I have two. Is that okay?
Yeah, as many as you want.
All right. So the first one is an app, actually. It's called the Points app, POINTZ. And it's an app for bicycle navigation. Okay. So it leverages a lot of the work that I've done improving the data quality of the bicycling infrastructure and OpenStreetMap. And so you can use it to plan your routes and select how safe or versus fast you want the route to be. And at least in Minneapolis and St. Paul, I find that it works really well. So I use it for most of my trips.
So, and what's the use case for this? Like, if I'm someone who doesn't know if a particular trail is open because of construction or something, like I live here, I know how to get around, but sometimes there's construction and I no longer know how to get around. Is this a good use case for that app? Or is it basically for people who are unacquainted?
That's part of it. Yeah, I think often it's for people who are biking somewhere that they haven't been before and want like just a safe biking route. Because it uses like the information on if you're going to be taking a bike lane, whether how fast the car traffic goes, what the speed limit is on the road, whether it has buffers, painted buffers, or like is actually a protected bike lane, or if it's next to parking, if you're riding in the door zone, those things are all factored into the calculation it makes for your route. So, you know. It loves the Midtown Greenway. I'll say that.
Okay. So
it takes me down there more often than I would have otherwise taken it.
Oh, does it change the decisions you make about where to bike?
It does. Yeah. I've definitely tried out different routes because of it and liked what it recommended.
Oh, well, that's quite a recommendation. What is your other recommendation?
Yeah. I'm just wrapping up a book called The Curse of Chalion by Lois McMaster Bujold. She actually lives in Minneapolis. And I had never heard of her before, but until this year, she's won 4 Hugo Awards, tied for the most ever for science fiction. And but this particular book is a fantasy novel. It's the first in a series, and the characters, the plotting, everything's just really sharp, and it's been a nice morsel to read before bed every night for the last month or two.
So what is this author's name?
Lois McMaster Bujold. The last name is spelled Bujold.
Okay. So I feel like you've broken You've broken a cardinal rule of the Wedge Live podcast, which is never mention a local sci-fi author who is not Naomi Kritzer.
I like Naomi as well. I've read a couple of Naomi's books. Yeah. But it seems like, you know, if I'm somebody who reads sci-fi and fantasy, and I just never heard of this author before. And so I think that she deserves a little more local credit than she's gotten.
Yeah. Read local, everyone. Here we go into the sign off. Okay. Thank you to my guest, Jordan Like, who is no longer Jim Jorts on Twitter. And thank you for listening. This has been the Wedge Live Podcast. I'm your host, John Edwards. Goodbye.
This is a real thing. Real thing. None of you have the balls to stop this.
Today.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now. 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 Right now.